Hey everyone, welcome back to one of my very favorite places to be, the Forum, where science comes to socialize, of course. I'm Aubrey, and with me today are Cleo and Daniela. Let's get the customary introductions out of the way today, shall we?
Hey guys, Cleo here. Thanks for tuning in today. On behalf of everyone at the Institute on Science for Global Policy, we really, truly appreciate your support of the forum.
And I'm Daniela. Ditto to what Cleo said. We're glad to have you back and hope you'll also join us on our social media channels for even more science and society discussion even after you finish today's episode. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook using @ISGPForum.
Alrighty, so what are we chatting about today?
Well, the paper we'll unravel today is titled Droughts Challenge Water Resource Management and Policy. And it was written by Miss Elaine Wheaton, a climate scientist and adjunct professor at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon, Canada.
Oh, that's awesome. We have another paper from Canada today.
Oh no, I know where this is going. For the listeners who aren't as acquainted with Daniela as Cleo and I, let's just say there's a long list of things Daniela likes about Canada. They range from the hipster culture of Vancouver to the French feel of Quebec. So, Cleo, why don't you get us started before we give Daniela any more of a Canadian soapbox?
All right. So, Ms. Wheaton's paper was debated at the 2015 conference, Living with Less Water, convened by the ISGP in collaboration with the Tucson Working Group at the University of Arizona. In the briefest of summaries, Ms. Wheaton explores the issues surrounding water management in a time when we really need to be thinking about our decreasing supply of water.
So, is our supply decreasing because droughts are increasing? Where are droughts happening? Are changes in drought patterns connected to climate change? So many questions.
And you're probably not alone with these questions because droughts are actually super elusive and kind of hard to understand. But don't worry, we'll do our best today to demystify them a little for you.
Which is why we should first mention that the debaters agreed that momentum is needed when it comes to developing research practices to actually understand droughts.
Not to mention that this system needs to be developed in a way that can be shared and used all across the scientific community.
Right, so this could include models that more accurately predict where droughts will be centered and the spatial area they could potentially cover, as well as sudden weather pattern changes and seasonal initiation and temporal length. Or in other words, droughts that begin in winter instead of summer and last the entire winter.
Climate predictions by scientists are developed using models based on sets of assumptions that are generally well informed, but these models don't predict what future drought patterns will be, just what they could be.
Right, but it's important to note that no existing model in any field can tell you what something will be. The concept of modeling is making well-informed and evidence-based predictions. However, that does not mean that a bit of uncertainty makes the predictions invalid. To assess the validity of predictions and their impacts, then, research practices should be streamlined between experts. That's why developing a system of research practices using these models is crucial, because new studies reveal that the frequency of severe droughts is, in fact, increasing.
And while the frequency of droughts is increasing, understanding their modus operandi is challenging because there's significant variability regarding how droughts begin and evolve.
Right, and climate change is actually exacerbating these difficulties. Let's put it this way. Droughts don't behave in a specific or consistent manner. Instead, their characteristics are morphing with the changing climate system.
It's reasonable to assume, based on scientific research, that future droughts may have faster onsets, last longer, or become more extreme in other ways. This could include aspects like drought area coverage, intensity, and frequency, with interruptions by intense rainfalls. And no, people, just because you get one random rainstorm in the middle of a many-month-long drought does not mean your drought is over and that you can go back to watering your lawn every day.
Truer words were never spoken. But beyond variability and drought evolution, there are several challenges surrounding drought management that the debaters discussed.
You're right. One of the most significant challenges, and one that we actually often discuss in development management, is the need to address urban population growth and its increasing water demand, especially under drought conditions that exacerbate water scarcity.
And of course, I have to mention our favorite topic, agriculture.
Your favorite topic?
All right, whatever. As it is one of, if not the most, drought-sensitive sectors of the global economy. We absolutely cannot forget that food security is especially threatened when water scarcity is coupled with rapid and continuously increasing global population.
But it's not all doom and gloom here. In speaking to these challenges, geoengineering technologies may provide viable options for adapting to climate change. They're definitely accompanied by difficulties, though, as are seemingly all climate change solutions. For example, solar radiation management strategies require more research and raise global liability issues.
I'm sorry, what?
Solar radiation management strategies are a type of climate geoengineering that try to reduce global warming by reflecting sunlight back into space.
You know how the greenhouse effect causes some of the sun's radiation to be trapped near the surface of the Earth? Well, solar radiation management, in theory, would limit the amount of that radiation reaching the Earth in the first place. It can be accomplished by injecting certain aerosols into the stratosphere, for instance. If you're interested in learning more about solar radiation management and other types of climate geoengineering, for that matter, the Forum will actually be hosting its next virtual workshop on this very topic in September, and will be collaborating with groups from American University and Arizona State. So be sure to keep up with our Facebook and Twitter accounts for more info on this event. I'm definitely excited about it.
Totally. In any case, let's finish up this convo about geoengineering as somewhat of a precursor to the September event. Where were we here?
Right, so some of the principal advantages cited in the geoengineering space include the speed with which certain strategies can be deployed and become fully active, their potential low financial costs, and the reversibility of their direct climatic effects. Disclaimer though, not all of these advantages apply to all geoengineering strategies, and there are many proposed strategies indeed.
But it's also important to note that solar radiation management doesn't reduce greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere, and thus can't really address other problems such as ocean acidification.
But for our purposes, speaking about drought, these projects could, for example, be used as a temporary response to mitigate global temperature increases while we develop other greenhouse gas remediation techniques and, you know, get our emissions under control.
So these projects are a viable opportunity?
Yeah, but like Aubrey mentioned, we need to do more research on solar radiation management, and international agreements on this technology may prove to be a limitation.
All right, well, what about water desalination? The debaters mentioned this as another option to mitigate the impacts of droughts. I mean, surely we have enough water out there in the oceans to help us when it comes to water scarcity. Desalination could provide additional freshwater resources, especially during periods of drought.
Right, but the problem is that water desalination is costly and energy intensive, which, if scaled up, actually means it could cause even higher than projected levels of atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations. More greenhouse gases exacerbate climate change, which may lead to more frequent intensive droughts. So this would actually just be a vicious cycle of trying to solve a problem by contributing to its cause.
Never mind then. Well, fortunately, drought planning has been gaining momentum across the global community, and countries are investing in research that informs actionable policy development.
The United States has taken a state-by-state approach to drought planning, which allows individual jurisdictions to tailor drought mitigation and resiliency strategies to meet their specific geographical and resource needs.
The National Drought Mitigation Center was established in the U.S. at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln to develop and implement research programs focused on monitoring drought, as well as design plans to minimize societal vulnerability to those droughts.
Many drought preparedness programs are stressing the need for adaptation planning and risk management, as opposed to crisis response management.
And shout out to the motherland, as South American countries have also been more engaged in the development of drought management practices, including exploring water deficits and surpluses and how to best distribute resources during water-constrained time periods.
But debaters emphasize that along with looking at the different causes of droughts, it's actually necessary to identify how the causes are changing under the shifting climate system, and whether these causal differences can potentially guide policy approaches.
As such, researchers are looking into potential combinations of causes to identify accurate drought indicators and areas affected.
And an interesting consequence of drought that is not currently considered in preparedness management, but should be, is that when droughts end with extreme rainfall, other drought characteristics may remain. These include groundwater depletion, poor plant growth, and insufficient reservoir filling.
And on top of that, predicting the length of droughts is tricky because some drought-breaking rainstorms are very localized. So they may not end the drought in the full region, instead just within that small spatial area.
Right, but to help us understand droughts better, we need better research, right? I mean, we started this entire episode saying that. But the fact of the matter is that improving research systems is costly, and it's difficult to prioritize climate and environmental funding in general because technology upgrades and infrastructure retrofits are necessary, as is public education and outreach. Basically, we're back to a prioritization problem.
However, if the public can achieve greater drought, climate, and environmental literacy, this knowledge can be leveraged to generate useful data and information. Think about the possibility of crowdsourced precipitation levels, for instance.
Scientific research surrounding drought monitoring, adaptation, and mitigation must be widely communicated to the public. Many dense scientific papers on drought effects have to be distilled into accessible, clear information that can reach and inform non-experts. And, you know, not to be biased at all, but podcasts seem like a pretty fun way to do it.
Well, the debaters didn't mention podcasts, but they did urge that there's an immediate need to create a public understanding of drought behavior, water scarcity threats, and preparedness. This is especially true in developed nations, such as the US and Canada, where the public has significant influence over policy decision making.
Data needs to be reported more widely, as well as explained in context to the public.
Which, like Aubrey alluded to, kind of further justifies spending our time on this podcast to educate our audiences on these issues, which makes me feel a little bit better about procrastinating on my exam revision.
I guess you have a point there, but explaining clearly to the public does have its issues because experts have their own and sometimes conflicting ways of understanding data and understanding each other for that matter.
What do you mean?
Well, it was questioned whether communication gaps exist between the social science researchers and the physical science researchers in understanding each other, as well as, I guess more specifically for today's topic, in how to communicate drought and drought-related impacts.
For example, the different definitions of drought used by social scientists and physical scientists can lead to confusion and communication breakdowns.
So, debaters suggested that there are opportunities for physical and social scientists to stay current in sharing information and cooperate in this research. Physical scientists could, let's say, provide cutting-edge drought modeling research or adaptation technologies, while social scientists could develop community behavior research during drought and non-drought periods.
So, collaboration seems to be key here, as there was consensus that communication to educate the public on drought and climate change must emphasize changes in both environmental and societal factors because decisions require current, not just future, attention.
Although education programs on climate and environment exist, these programs generally are ranked low on the priority list and are allocated scant funding.
We should probably focus on investment in education, as it can be increasingly valuable when it comes to long-term benefits.
Right. Debaters agreed that education and outreach, including early childhood education, we're talking K-12 here, need to be prioritized in drought and climate change program development. Engaging the public on drought monitoring and having scientists communicate, especially when they are using publicly generated citizen science-based data, can potentially break down barriers in public outreach.
And while information on droughts is improving, accurate projections remain difficult, and surprises should be expected. Therefore, policymakers can no longer rely on older, established program solutions to respond to current drought impacts. New and more novel adaptation strategies are needed, and happily are currently being developed by research institutions and government partnerships.
This scientific research needs to develop in two different paths. One along the lines of mitigation and reducing total greenhouse gas emissions, and another focused on finding adaptation strategies that increase resiliency and reduce societal vulnerability to drought within, you know, a particular area. Drought mitigation and adaptation policies are considered in really their own separate silos, but they're inherently linked and policy needs to consider them in tandem.
Policymakers need to make decisions and build programs to address the changing climate based on drought science research in collaboration with all stakeholders.
So, in other words, communication among the scientific community, the public, and government is key to build alliances and understand how and when to act proactively, as well as what to do when immediate responses are required. Within communities, especially those vulnerable to drought, teams of experts comprised of physical researchers, social researchers, and policymakers need to be formed.
And these teams should exist within different communities because each community will have different priorities influenced by social, economic, and cultural factors. So inevitably, decisions about how to prioritize use of scarce water will require input from all of these stakeholders.
Well, we've now successfully used the S word, stakeholders, multiple times. So let's go over what we've covered today and wrap up before we start abusing other ISGP favorite phrases.
Oh, you mean silver bullet, public-private partnerships, and funding?
Oh, we're doing so well this time.
All right, so we can all agree that the main point today is stakeholder involvement because it's essential for the success of policies that address drought and other climate-related hazards.
And to develop these successful policies, short and long-term forecasts on industry development and other local and regional economic drivers, such as urban planning, need to be considered to create a holistic approach to climate change mitigation and adaptation.
So, seeing as you are some of the key stakeholders involved in the climate change conversation, how about we start right here?
Have you witnessed communities that have been proactive and successful when it comes to drought management? What did they do well, and how, if at all, can their strategies be employed in other communities?
What can be done to get the public more involved? And how important is community involvement anyway? We've heard what the experts had to say, but now we want to hear from you.
Connect with us on Twitter at ISGP Forum or on Facebook to let us know your thoughts.
Thanks for taking the time to socialize with science today. See you next time, right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.